Well, I'm going to come back to this theme Ayin has brought up for us kind of in different ways from some different angles, but let me start with a story. Earlier this year, I got on an airplane to visit a friend of mine, and I took the trip afraid that I would lose that friend. But I ended up on this trip in that friend seeing the face of God. What happened is I was nervous because there was a few things that my friend and I hadn't spoken of in years, a couple of really important topics which I knew that we had come to see differently but hadn't spoken of. Like most friends, you know, after 10 years, 20 years, about 25 years, in our case, both of us have been learning and growing and changing and sometimes in a little bit different directions. Now, I was asking myself, like, what happens if all that life and all that change ruins the friendship? Like, what if we find out that we've grown apart? What happens when a friendship can't bear the weight of so much difference or so much change? I didn't think this particular friendship would be at risk because this is the guy that was the best man in my wedding. We've been godfathers of some of each other's children and played, you know, important roles in our kids' lives. We logged dozens and dozens of hours on the phone as we've lived in different cities most of the year since then. But not long before this trip, another friend of mine told me a story of a lifelong best friendship she had lost because she and this good friend of hers no longer saw eye to eye on a single important topic, and her friend had essentially disowned her over this. And I thought as I heard that story, like, my God, like, what if that could happen in my life as well? What if one of my best friends, like the dearest, you know, people to me in the world, will no longer trust me or no longer respect me? So I get on that plane, I land, my friend picks me up at the airport, and we stop at a park to take a walk for a little while. I think he had a young kid at home that needed to finish their nap or something. And I said, hey, can we clear the air for a bit? I've got something important to talk about. I was so much more nervous than I expected to be. I'm a grown man, I'm here with an old friend of mine, but my hands are in my pockets, I'm kind of shaking a little bit, and I can't find the words to say to start this conversation. Eventually, though, I bring up the stuff that I knew we didn't see eye to eye on anymore, but I hoped we could talk about. And I tell him I needed to bring this up because I'm not sure what'll happen if, like, we're about to lose our friendship over this. And he says to me, well, there's a long answer, Steve. Like, let's talk about this, you know? Probably a lot to talk about. But he said to me right away, before anything else, the short answer, though, is like, my God, no. We're friends, right? Like, a friendship can handle some difference, like even some really important difference. Like, I think we're good, and turns out we were. This is so obvious, or at least should be so obvious, and yet, like, the air sort of suddenly came back into my lungs in hearing that. I was so relieved. I thought, this is the taste of some of the best in life. Like, I was really worried I was going to lose this friend. But loyalty, acceptance, like, peace between us that can handle some significant difference. That was so good to hear. And so I looked at my friend. I remember, like, kind of melodramatically thinking in that moment, like, to see your face is like to see the face of God. Those words aren't mine. They came to me from somewhere else. They're from an old, old story in our scriptures. When one man sees the face of his brother, and in a space, brief space of trust and reconciliation, also comes to see the embodied in his brother's face, the very face of the living God. This moment's from the third quarter of the Bible's first book of Genesis. Genesis is four long stories that get woven into one, and each of these four stories centers around a person who's chosen by God. And all four of these stories around these four chosen people are full of loss and full of death. The family at the center of each story, sometimes all of humanity, is at risk, is threatened. And the stories ask, how is it that God can be faithful to advance goodness in the midst of all this difficulty? They also ask where God can be faithful too, often with really surprising answers. And each of these four sections in Genesis has, as part of the tale, a really significant rivalry at the center. And the rivalry at the center of this third section of Genesis is between the twin brothers, Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau, we're told, have been competitors since birth. Younger brother Jacob has consistently had the upper hand, and with the help of his mother, he's managed to steal the favored son's status from his brother. He's managed to steal the favored inheritance status from his brother as well. And then from that moment until the time when we'll meet them today, about 15 years have passed. 15 years in which they have never seen each other. 15 years of Jacob thinking his brother Esau wanted him dead. And now Jacob, along with his very large family, is preparing for a reunion. When he hears Esau is coming to greet him, not with his own family, but with a large group of armed men. So Jacob plans on sending his servants and his family members ahead of him with gifts, as you do in this situation, like hoping to somehow appease his brother. And here's what happens. I'll read you a couple excerpts from this moment in their story. I'll read from this translation you may not have heard before. It's called the Schocken Translation. We've printed that in your programs. It's a really interesting modern translation by this great Jewish scholar named Everett Fox. It keeps the poetic flavor and feel of the Hebrew language behind this, so it'll sound a little different if you heard it before. Jacob here is called by his Hebrew name, Yaakov, and Esau by his name, Esav. And Jacob, or Yaakov, says this to his servants. You shall say also, here your servant Yaakov is behind us. For he said to himself, I will wipe the anger from his face with the gift that goes ahead of my face. Afterward, when I see his face, perhaps he will lift up my face. The gift crossed over ahead of his face, but he spent the night on that night in the camp. So the whole section, as probably heard obvious to you, is this becomes his meditation on the word face. Yaakov thinks Esau's face is angry. So he wants the first thing that Esau sees when he comes along not to be his face, but his butter up his brother gifts. He sends them ahead in the hopes that when they eventually come together face to face, something good might happen. I don't think Yaakov dares to hope for reconciliation or a deep peace or anything like that. I think he just wants to survive this encounter. We read, and Yaakov was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the coming up of dawn. So this is like a really unexpected twist in the story, that in the middle of the night, camping by himself along the riverbank, Yaakov is attacked. Perhaps a thief has discovered this rich man is all alone in the wilderness. Perhaps his big brother has snuck up on him in the night to take his revenge. In the end, Yaakov comes to believe that neither of these are true, but that this person he's wrestling with is like no ordinary man, but an angel or some other like mysteriously like embodied presence of the living God. And so Yaakov hangs on to this man he's fighting with for dear life, stopping fighting anymore, but like seeking the blessing of God until it's given to him. We read then, Yaakov called the name of this place Peniel, or face of God. For I have seen God face to face, and my life has been saved. So the meditation on this whole passage in the word face continues. In this strange mystical encounter, Yaakov believes he's seen God face to face and lived. And so from now on, both he and his ancestors are named not Yaakov, but Yisrael, God fighter, which is this name of power, right? That you could fight with God or grapple with God, struggle with God, interact face to face with the divine. It's also, though, a name of vulnerability because from here on out, Yaakov, now Yisrael, walks with a limp. He's wounded in this encounter as if to say, like, to be face to face with God is also to become profoundly aware of your own limits, your own weakness, your own vulnerability. And so the legacy of Yaakov's ancestors, like both biological and sort of spiritual, is this blessing of exalted and vulnerable personhood. To be able to see God face to face, to be made profoundly resilient and strong through this encounter with God, but also to be made profoundly humble, profoundly vulnerable as well. This is really wild and dramatic. It's very important in Yaakov's life and the life of his story to come, but it's not the climax of the story. The climax comes on the next day when Yaakov limps away from the riverbed and finally sees his brother again, hoping against hope he might survive, only to discover that his brother actually wants peace. Esau says he has enough. He just wants to be brothers again. He said, meaning Esau, what to you is all this camp that I have met? He said, to find favor in my Lord's eyes. Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. Let what is yours remain yours. Yaakov said, no, I pray. Pray if I have found favor in your eyes, then take this gift from my hand. For I have, after all, seen your face as one sees the face of God, and you have been gracious to me. I've seen your face, Yaakov says, as one sees the face of God. Jacob would know, right? He just had this profound spiritual experience. He uniquely knows a thing or two about what it's like to see the face of God. And he looks at his brother face to face and thinks, this is what is happening. To see you accepting me, for us to be at peace without barrier, without wall, like person to person, is for me to see in your face the face of God. It's sort of a sad epilogue to the story for Jacob Yaakov. This proves too much for Jacob. This intimacy of full personhood, brother to brother, is somehow so unfamiliar or so threatening that within a day, Jacob has moved on, perhaps never to see his brother again. We don't know, but he kind of flees from the experience of intimacy. But for a moment, he has that restored connection, that peace to see the face of God in the face of his brother. This is what I got with my good friend, as I told you about. For us, it wasn't the result of reconciliation per se. It was more the relief of not losing a precious friendship, of kind of a potential friendship-ending conflict being averted. Made this friendship really important to us, but through years of vulnerable trust, years of being there for each other, decades of mutual support. So for me, to not lose that friendship, but to kind of reclaim our connection, our peace, our freedom to be fully present to one another with whatever we need to talk about, that was to sense God with me. I wonder what you think about this idea in your life, that our best chance to see the face of God is to see God's love and presence reflected in a human face. In churches, we talk a lot about personal attempts to experience God, to encounter in some way, to encounter God's face in our personal practice. So we encourage shared worship, collective experiences like we're having today. We encourage patterns and habits of prayer, of reading the scriptures, of spiritual practices of all kinds. In fact, we promote different kinds of spiritual practices each week here as part of our teaching. And all this is really valuable. There's a reason we do so much of that. We're a faith community, so we promote faith. We promote trust in God, even encounter with God, like to try to experience the love and power from which all of us and everything is born. But the scriptures teach that the Word of God, like the one perfect revelation of the divine to humans, is in the person of Jesus. And they also teach that the face of God, the image of God, is seen in human personhood on one another's faces. So again, I wonder what you think about this, that in this life, our best opportunity to see the face of God is to see God's love and presence revealed on another human's face. And that similarly, like our deepest opportunity for human connection comes when we're able to see the full glory of a human, to see that that human in front of us is in fact an image bearer of the living God. My own experience is that at least these days, maybe all days, we're not getting enough of this. This is like a hard experience to come by in our daily life. We don't often enough see the face of God on one another's faces. I think we rarely see the full glory of our fellow humans, that we are all image bearers of our God. I think we have a significant problem in our times with this kind of personhood. I heard a talk recently by an old colleague of mine who's gone on to like larger, more famous platforms as a speaker and as an author. His name's Andy Crouch, and he gave this talk recently called Overcoming Our Greatest Affliction. And most of the rest of my material comes from that talk, so preachers steal stuff all the time, but I tell you when I steal stuff. So we'll put the notes to his talk on the sermon notes online if you want to listen to his talk. It's a little longer. There's some more depth to it. But Andy in that talk discusses three revolutions that he says make the world the way it is today. He talks about the financial revolution, when wealth went from primarily based in land to money. The industrial revolution, when work shifted mainly from labor we do with our bodies to mainly labor that machines do for us. And then the computational revolution, when knowledge shifted from being housed more in humans and being more inclined maybe toward possessing wisdom, and knowledge went mainly to information. And I'll skip the details or analysis on these revolutions, but the idea is that in these revolutions and in others that have made the modern world what it is, they've brought humanity great wealth. So the average American, most of us, have access to like goods and services and a kind of material quality of living that would have been like the fantasy of royalty in times past. It's a wealthy world we live in. These revolutions have also given us access to great health. So not only does a much smaller percentage of the world live in abject poverty than used to be true, but the majority of the world lives much longer lives and much less sick lives than used to be so, even just a couple generations ago. And all of this has brought us all some measure of greater happiness. So praise God for all these revolutions. They've done a lot of good things for us. And yet, there's kind of a flip side that maybe you thought about the technology piece earlier. And that all of us in our times are also more lonely and more anxious and more depressed than humans have tended to find themselves maybe in past ages. Because in most of these revolutions that have given us life as we know it today, we've made a kind of trade. We've traded personhood for power. Most of the people I see each day don't really see me, aren't really seen by me. Most of the people I see each day certainly do not know my name. Even most weeks, when I think of most of the people I talk with that do know my name, don't really know my story, they don't know where I come from, they don't know a lot about me. In the Jacob and Esau story, the pain and conflict ruptures personhood, and we certainly experience that as well. But now the whole world ruptures personhood as well. Andy says we live in this lonely world of engines and machines and information, so that modernity is a great place to have power, but it's not such a great place to be a person. I think of a friend of mine, for instance, who was trained as a social worker and was eager to launch a career helping vulnerable people actually experience more goodness and dignity in their personhood. In his first placement, though, he was totally overwhelmed and discouraged by the bureaucracy of his institution. He was discouraged, you know, really by modern institutions' habit of prioritizing abstract principles and procedures over people. He was also overwhelmed by some of the technological and administrative demands of the work. And so he quit. People called it burnout. He sunk into a considerable depression, a long period of unemployment. He found he didn't want to get back into social work. He eventually found a job that he's kept in like wholesale supplies. For him, the work hasn't felt meaningful, though. He doesn't like his work very much. And like many people who work doing physical labor with his bodies, he has aches and pains that have aged him like well beyond his years. So he feels, like many of us do in our work, more like a tool than a person. He's depressed sometimes still. He hasn't shaken that. And he's also, like many people who work in jobs with not great benefits, he's chronically anxious about his health and about his finances too. And I think about his story and I think, oh, it's not all that unique. It's actually a pretty classic story of what modernity looks like in the 21st century for the economic losers in our society. That's my friend's story. And yeah, I think for all of those of us who might be on the economic winning side of our times, we're pretty stressed out too. And we're pretty lonely. Like a lot of us go from day to day, like not seeing the face of God in ourselves or in anyone else. Andy, in his talk on personhood, argues that this actually happened before. There's good news in that. He argues that the Roman Empire experienced its own revolutions that increased power but decreased personhood. So the Roman Empire at the time of Jesus produced incredible prosperity and abundance, some ways unknown to the earth by that point, for the people whose names we know. But in their society, the distribution of personhood was profoundly unequal. Very few people were considered fully persons, literally, were recognized with the standing of a person. Only the patriarchal heads of households had the full benefit of personhood. But children, women, slaves, the great majority of the empire were viewed as less than full people. In fact, for slaves, given that you didn't have a chance of ever becoming a real person, you weren't even usually given a real name. So if you were a Roman slave, you might just be named for your birth order: Tertius, Quartus, Quintus, Third, Fourth, Fifth. Or you might be named for some productive quality you might have for the economy. You might be named Useful. In Greek, is the name Onesimus. And these names bring us to these remarkable lines at the very end of a letter in the New Testament. This letter called Romans, we hear throughout that there's this famous faith entrepreneur, this apostle Paul, who for 16 chapters had all kinds of things to say. And at the end of that 16 chapter, we get this. It's the second scripture in your program. We read, "I, Tertius, the writer of this letter, greet you in the Lord. Gaius, who is host to me and to the whole church, greets you. Erastus, the city treasurer, and our brother Quartus greet you." So who is this Tertius? He's a scribe, the one who's written all of Paul's other words down for him in this long letter. He may or may not be a slave, but he's a person of very low status, there to take down the words of other more important people. Tertius, third. Paul says, "Tertius, you speak now, because you're a brother too. Tertius, you take a turn. Say what you have to say." And then Tertius helps us meet Gaius, who's this wealthy man, the one whose household hosts the whole community, he says, the benefactor of their local church. You might say the top financial giver in their community. Tertius says, "My friend Gaius says hello." Oh, and as does Erastus, the treasurer of our whole city. And our brother, fourth, Quartus, he says hello too. Quartus may be Tertius's brother by birth, perhaps a slave himself. He sends greetings too. Can you hear what's happening here? Two of the most powerful and wealthy men of Rome, known to their culture, known to history by their names, they share friendship. They share connection. They share meals in their home with Tertius and Quartus, known to their culture and to history as nobodies, the very low status, third and fourth. And yet they're family. They're known to one another. And each of them, Paul looks at their face and sees the face of God. This is like a good news miracle. Tertius and Paul together finish up here. The letter ends with their words, "Now to God, who is able to strengthen you according to my gospel and the proclamation of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery that was kept secret for long ages, but is now disclosed, and through the prophetic writings is made known to all the Gentiles, according to the command of the eternal God to bring about the obedience of faith to the only wise God through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever. Amen." There's a psychologist named Kurt Thompson, and he says that from birth, we are looking for a face who is looking for us. What it means to be human is to want to see and know someone who's looking for us, who wants to see and know us too. Part of the good news of Jesus is that God has become embodied in a human face, that God is eager to reconnect us both with God and with one another. And to do the will of God, what Paul calls the obedience of faith, as we trust and follow Jesus with our lives, is in part to see the face of God in the personhood of all humanities, to accept God's invitation to a life of reunion or reconnection. All of us, we're looking for a face in whom we can see the face of God, looking to have our own face seen by someone else this way too. What's weird is we sort of have a million chances at this. There are a lot of people in the world. We see a lot of human faces every week. And yet in a deeper level, we actually only have like a precious few chances at this in life. Here's what I mean, and this will take us to the first of the sort of two invitations for the week. This one for sort of a whole life flourishing, like a way to think about flourishing in your life. I want you to think for a minute of the 5 to 10 people you are most connected to in your life. Right? People like, you know, at the end of your life, these will be some of the most important relationships you ever had. How might you be the face of God to them? Is there a relationship like that needs reconciliation? Do you have room for a tertius in your circle to better validate the personhood of someone outside that full experience? Perhaps you're doing that right now already. I say 5 to 10 people because, again, every day we encounter people. We do have so many chances to look at a human face and to pause and to believe that we could see the face of God there. We also have so many chances in our lives to be present to the humans in front of us, to be marked by faith, hope, and love so much that they can see the face of God on our face, whether they're looking for it or not. But most of us also, in our lives, really only have a few people, maybe 5, maybe 10, who we're like intimately engaged with over many decades. Talking like people like parents, children, partners, best friends, people you manage to be close or connected to with over decades. Most of us don't get a lot of those people in our lives. So I think it's worth starting with those people, as Jacob did. For the very closest people in your life, is it possible to see the face of God on their face? Does someone come to mind where things are estranged or when you need reconciliation? We'll pray about that in a second. I also wonder again, like, what does it mean to have room in our lives for a tertius, for someone like outside our own band of privilege, however we'd consider that? I've also invited you to the spiritual practice this week to imagine, like, as a consumer, as a worker, as a user of technology, like really in all the domains of our lives, what does it mean to look, to see and affirm personhood? To look for the face of God in more human faces. Could we take a minute to consider that, to pray over that as our band comes up? You can take a pause and close your eyes, or leave them open if you want, but it's just kind of avert your gaze from other people. And I'd love us to give us the opportunity to reflect on these invitations for a moment, to practice them a bit, even now while we're together. God of peace, God of love, God of reunion, of reconnection, of relationship, could you be present with us now? I invite you, as I ask a couple questions and pray a couple prayers, to sort of parade before your mind the handful of people whom your life is most bound up with. Picture their names and faces as I ask you questions and pray. Again, if you're not sure who I mean, you might think of parents, partners, old, long, deep friendships, children, anyone you've got years of history with or years of history in front of you, you expect. As you think of these names, as you picture these faces, ask yourself, can I see the face of God on their face? Don't make yourself say yes, just ask the question, can I see the face of God on their face? If the answer is yes, what does that say to you? If the answer is no, why is that? If I'm honest as I do this, I have some yeses and some noes. God, could you do the work of your Spirit in us? Yeah, I was going to ask the other, but I want to say it's just in us. Do the work of your Spirit in us to restore our capacity to see your face reflected on the faces of those people closest to us. Do in us the work of forgiveness, do in our relationship the work of restoration or reconciliation. Help us see as you see. And God, even as we finish our time, gather together and worship, could you work in our minds and hearts by your Spirit, that we could be filled with all the fullness of God, be the face of God to our friends and neighbors. Amen.